This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The heat of the earth is everywhere. We only know how to tap it economically in certain instances today, but we're learning how to do it in many, many new areas.
Humans have been capturing and using geothermal heat from the earth for a very long time. Geothermal energy was being used in China back in the 3rd century BC, and the ancient Romans, of course, used it to heat their baths and their buildings. Now, in the 21st century, geothermal power comprises a significant portion of the energy grid in countries ranging from the Philippines to Nicaragua. Today on Sea Change Radio, I talk with Carl Gaywell, Executive Director of the Geothermal Energy Association, an organization that advocates for the expansion of geothermal for electricity production. He explains how geothermal works, tells us who the major players are in the industry, and talks about what needs to happen to move the United States toward fully embracing this ancient but largely untapped resource. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Carl Gaywell, the Executive Director of the Geothermal Energy Association. Carl, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi.
First, tell us about the Geothermal Energy Association. What kind of organization is it, and what's your mission?
Well, we're a trade association of companies that are basically working here in the U.S. and around the world to develop geothermal energy resources. And we have an outside lobbying firm that does lobbying for companies that contribute to that. But GEA itself doesn't directly lobby, although we're involved in public policy issues, you know, across the United States. So we are an advocacy group, but we're advocacy for using more geothermal resources to meet our clean power needs.
Carl, can you explain to us the difference between geothermal power and geothermal hot water?
Well, I think there's a range of geothermal, and when we talk about geothermal, predominantly my companies represent the power side of the industry or the direct use side. We also have some heat pump members as well, and because we're already using the heat that's available in the earth. With a geothermal heat pump, you might be using the heat at a shallow depth to provide you some heat in the winter and cooling in the summer because the ground maintains a constant temperature at a specific depth. But there's also great opportunities for using higher, medium and higher temperature resources for everything from commercial purposes to building heating to spas and recreation. There are hundreds of sites in the United States that utilize geothermal resources for heating purposes like that. And in other countries, for example, in Iceland, it's the predominant use of geothermal energy. The biggest use in Iceland for geothermal is building heating and commercial heating, not power production. They do a lot of power production, but heating is the big value. We also see that in areas like Eastern Europe and in other countries. China has a tremendous effort in geothermal heating. And then in the U.S., we have been the leaders in power production. But for power production, you need to have higher temperature resources, which is one of the reasons why a lot of the early power development was in areas like California, where because of the plate boundaries, which you're close to, you have a lot of high temperature resources. But that's changing too, because we've developed technology to allow us to produce geothermal from medium and lower temperature resources. So we've gone from seeing geothermal power in only a few states, for example, California, Nevada, and Hawaii, which in 2005 was most of our production, to today, we have projects under development, power projects under development in 16 states, ranging from Texas all the way up to Alaska. And that's the type of development. It's not just do we want to see new power projects, but there really is a lot of potential future upside to developing new technologies that will allow us to, you know, not just build a few more plants today, but potentially turn this into a major energy resource.
Now, are there some regions around the globe where geothermal energy just doesn't make economic sense?
Well, I was going to start starting with what you really look at is what do we know about the geology, first of all, because we're still developing the technology that allows us to locate from the surface where a geothermal resource is. And I tell people an example to understand this is oil and gas development, because, you know, Dan Yergin wrote a book called The Prize about how the oil industry developed over many years. And he talked about in the early 1900s, people said we're running out of oil. And the reason they said we were running out of oil, because up until then, we developed oil because we saw it seeping out of the ground. We didn't have the technology to find the hidden oil fields. And we didn't develop that until the 20s and 30s of the 1900s. When we did, we discovered, guess what? There was a whole lot more oil out there than you could see just at oil seeps. Well, unfortunately, there hasn't really been a significant investment in geothermal exploration technology to allow us to have that sort of advanced technology to locate from the surface geothermal resources. So we're still doing a little bit of a blind hunting process here where, you know, you see a hot spring, you know there's a geothermal resource. We know that there's a lot of geothermal resource without surface manifestation because we've occasionally found them. Nevada Geothermal Power's new power plant in Nevada was built on a site that someone was using for a mining operation and literally dug into hot water. But the problem is you've got to have some understanding of the resource. So where you've got hot springs, as they did in Tibet, you've got a pretty good indication from the surface that there's something there. And the risk and the cost of going into areas where the resource is blind is just right now prohibitive. So, for example, in Washington, D.C., you can look at the geology and say, gee, if I drilled to 20,000 feet, I know that the rock is boiling hot. But we don't have the technology to allow you to create an artificial system yet, which is what they're working on. And we don't have the technology to find resources without drilling. And those are some of our holdups in terms of development. So you're seeing most geothermal resource development occurs in the areas we've already identified from the surface some resource. Even in the United States, the estimate is that the conventional geothermal resource, that 80% of it is yet to be discovered.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Carl Gaywell, the Executive Director of the Geothermal Energy Association. Can you tell us about how the technology works in terms of delivering electricity to our homes compared to coal, nuclear, gas, or even solar?
Sure. It's really actually a real interesting contrast. And, you know, years ago, I had heard Amory Lovins make the comment that nuclear power was the most complicated way to boil water. And having visited a nuclear power plant and having visited a geothermal power plant, I think these are the two extremes. Because at a nuclear facility, or for that matter, a coal or gas plant, what you're really doing is using all that heat that you're developing by either radioactivity or burning fossil fuels to boil water, to turn a turbine. And that turbine then is what turns a generator and produces the electricity. Well, in the case of geothermal energy, what you're looking for is you're looking for the spot where the earth has created essentially that natural system where you've got underground water and hot rocks intersecting. So when you drill into it, the water comes out of the well already boiling hot. And like at the geysers, the water comes out as almost pure steam. So you just then pipe the steam to the power plant where you don't have this maze of equipment and radioactive material and conveyor belts carrying coal up the side. I mean, you've got the steam already there, and you run it through the steam turbine generator, condense it back down. You might use some of it for cooling, but put most of it you're going to put back in the ground, which then comes back again in the future as additional steam. So you're using an essentially a natural power plant where the forces of nature have provided it. And what we're trying to learn to do is, one, to find those, and then secondly, how to engineer them, because the hot rocks are there at depths all around the world. The folks at Southern Methodist University and Google recently identified a resource, a hot rock resource in West Virginia, that they said could be capable of producing 18,000 megawatts of geothermal power. So, you know, we're still learning how to do it, but once you find a geothermal resource, It's a pretty, as the president of Nevada Energy once said, it's an elegant renewable resource because it provides continuous power, baseload power to the system, or it can vary the output. So it can provide a lot of reliability to the power system and does so with minimum land use. I think geothermal is about the smallest per acre use of any technology in terms of how much power it produces. And, nothing is without environmental impacts. Even a solar array has some issues, but geothermal and all most renewables have pretty minimal environmental impacts and very limited to no greenhouse gas emissions.
What are the biggest hurdles for geothermal besides the location of geothermal resources?
Well, I think the thing is you got the right context to have this discussion. And people think of geothermal as a spot that you're finding hot water, and that is what it is today. But really, what geothermal means is using the heat in the earth to produce power and energy. And I tell people, if you think of solar energy, you can look at the sun, you can sense how huge it is, and how frankly vast the resource is. But you can also say, pretty quickly get a sense that the problem is how do you collect it and use it economically. And that's what geothermal energy is all about. It's not just about power, but it's about using the heat of the earth for home heating or district heating, for power generation, and learning how to do it in many different new ways, because the heat of the earth is everywhere. We only know how to tap it economically in certain instances today, but we're learning how to do it in many, many new areas.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Carl Gaywell, the executive director of the Geothermal Energy Association. When many of us think of geothermal power from the earth, Carl, we tend to think of places like Yellowstone, which are also pristine landmarks. How does the geothermal industry deal with the issue of tapping into resources on sensitive lands?
Well, I mean, it's as far as we're concerned in the United States and North America and most areas of the world right now, that's not an issue because most companies are not going to want to develop anywhere near a national park. They're going to stay away from areas that are considered sensitive, and that's not a problem because there is so much to be developed outside of those systems. The same thing would be true, for example, of trying to build a power plant in San Francisco. The mayor of San Francisco and a previous mayor once asked me, well, what about this? There's this huge red spot right next to San Francisco in the Pacific Ocean. Couldn't we develop that for geothermal energy? And I said, well, that's the San Andreas Fault. And no one in their right mind is going to come close to that. I mean, you just wouldn't want to take the risk and you wouldn't want to take the blame. But again, the good news for geothermal is we have at least 10,000 megawatts in identified sites that don't involve parks, they don't involve sacred, protected lands, they don't involve areas which should face barriers to development. And if we could develop those, that's going to keep us pretty busy for the next few years. And then there's more beyond that. So first of all, let's start with the places that don't pose those conflicts before we even, get into it. I think it may be more of an issue where you're going to face really tough trade-offs, which we're not facing in the United States. And one place, for example, where I think that could be more of an issue would be in Japan. Given the recent Fukushima disaster, much of the traditional resource in Japan or geothermal resource involves either parks or culturally significant bathing areas. But again, that's the conventional resource. I don't think Japan has really looked to see where advanced technology could allow it to use geothermal energy, and Japan is virtually all the islands sit on top of very geothermally active systems. So advanced technology may allow Japan to develop in areas outside of those conflict zones.
Now, who are some of the big players in the geothermal industry, Carl, in terms of private and public investors in the technology?
Well, I mean, the major companies developing geothermal energy today are Cal Energy in Southern California. Calpine operates the geysers and is building some additional projects in that area. Ormat, which is out of Reno, Nevada, is building projects both in numerous states and around the world. They may be one of the largest developers. TerraGen Power. TerraGen is also headquartered out of Reno and is, frankly, one of the biggest renewable power developers across the board. And I could go on. You could actually look at our website, geo-energy.org, and see all of the different projects under development and who's developing them. One of the new things we're seeing that geothermal developers tend to be renewable developers. So, for example, whether it's Cal Energy or TerraGen, they're not just big geothermal developers, they're also big wind, solar developers as well. So there tends to be sort of a cross-company platform on renewables that is evolving both in the U.S. and around the world. Enel Green Power, one of the largest companies, Enel is one of the largest companies in Europe, for example, is developing that same type of cross-renewable development platform. We're also seeing a lot of interest amongst co-ops in the West, which we have had some, we've had Northern California Power Authority involved in geothermal development. But in the Northwest, particularly as they look at changes in what type of power BPA is going to be providing, we've had a significant new interest in Oregon, Washington, Montana from some of the co-ops in looking at developing new projects. And there's been a significant amount of interest in geothermal energy by Indian tribes from New Mexico to Montana and elsewhere in looking at developing not just geothermal power, but geothermal commercial, like crop drying activities, because they're very labor intensive and can often provide the kind of jobs that tribal groups are looking for in rural areas. I'd say if there is a common characteristics amongst geothermal companies, it's change. I think every time we do a finance workshop or a new program, half the people in the room I've never seen before, and which I think is really exciting because the diversity in the crowd has just grown in terms of every program we've got, it's less the same gray hairs, and it's now a lot, group of people that is both young and old, and virtually every type of background coming into that room, looking to say how can we do this. That has been helped by government policy, no question. The production tax credit in 2005, the stimulus bill in 2009, the stimulus bill not only extended the production tax credit, our production tax credit currently runs through the end of 2013, but it also said if you needed to, you could take the investment tax credit, one or the other, you can't take both, at a 30% investment tax credit rate, which some companies have said works better for them. And the stimulus bill also provided a big chunk of research and technology funding for geothermal. $400 million was earmarked in that bill for new technology. And it really was meant to implement a law that was passed in 2007 called the Advanced Geothermal Development Act, which was a bill passed by both houses of Congress on a very strong bipartisan basis that said there's a real future for technology in this area and kind of laid out a roadmap in that law that was funded in 2009. So we've seen a lot of new initiatives at the federal level and at the state level. There's strong interest in geothermal to meet their RPS demands, the renewable portfolio standards that have been adopted in Oregon, California, Nevada, and most of the western states. And geothermal is part of the mix. And I think, in fact, most of the utilities find it's a very valuable part of the mix because wind and solar are great, but they have limitations in terms of their intermittency. Geothermal brings to that mix a baseload power, and the two together give the utility a more vibrant power supply.
While Fuego es el amor y quema su calor. Cuando Hey, they say, con su ador yo me quemé. Yo sentí que sus llamas me abrazaban, con intenso ador y me devoraban. Preparó los dos, fuego de amor, fuego de amor.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest is Carl Gaywell, the Executive Director of the Geothermal Energy Association. Carl, how do you see geothermal fitting in the green jobs initiatives set forth by the Obama administration and others? And are there any trade issues surrounding geothermal similar to the solar industry where so much of the infrastructure is coming from China?
Yeah, you know, the green jobs initiatives are something that have really helped all the renewables, including geothermal energy, because and people don't realize it's a little bit counterintuitive for most company people to talk about this. But geothermal power plants really do employ a lot more, many more people than a traditional power plant. I was just in yesterday at a national conference here in Washington and listened to Cal Energy, MidAmerican Energy, make a presentation about its power plants in California. And for example, and it has 10 plants in Imperial County, California, which is one of the highest unemployment rates in the state. I think the unemployment rate in Imperial County is something like 30%. Those plants produce about 300 megawatts of power. And they have over 240 full-time employees at their plants. Well, what was interesting is MidAmerican said, well, if they compared that to their own natural gas plants, a 300-megawatt natural gas plant would have about 18 full-time employees. So you're going from 240 to 18. I mean, clearly the continued employment base that gives you is substantial. But they were also looking at building several new projects in California, which would take almost 4 years to build and would employ at the peak 640 construction workers, as well as leaving full-time employment in its path. And again, these are much higher numbers than you see with a typical natural gas plant or a fossil fuel plant. And part of that's because with a geothermal power plant, if you think of it this way, I think you understand that it's you are building the well field. So it's like, you know, you've got a natural gas field somewhere sending you gas. That gas then has to go through a pipeline for hundreds of miles and then end up at a power plant. Well, in a geothermal plant, you're building the well field, the pipeline supply system, and the power plant all on the same site. So it's a much more intensive operation, and because of that, has a substantially greater both construction workforce and full-time workforce for the project.
Let's move to geothermal hot water for a second, Carl. What factors go into a consumer tapping into geothermal energy for their homes?
Well, in the United States today, that's going to be done typically through a geothermal heat pump. So you're going to be looking at using a heat pump system that basically what it taps is the fact that at an 8-foot depth in the ground, and more depending on where you're at, you've got a pretty constant temperature of, you know, 50 to 60 degrees that, and what you're doing is almost—it's kind of like the reverse of a power plant. You're running a coil through that ground, and you're putting in it a fluid that allows the geothermal heat pump unit itself to tap the heat from the ground when it's cold outside. So it essentially is preheating the air to that temperature, and in cooling allows it to cool the air to that temperature just simply using that ground loop. They're really elegant systems because in one unit you often get your heating, your air conditioner, and your hot water heater all in one unit that looks rather a lot like a sort of a natural gas furnace. But the problem with them is the ground loop. It can be expensive and has to be installed and sized properly for the system to work. But we are seeing a significant growth. I think the geothermal heat pump installations in the United States are growing something like 30% a year. And in many states across the United States, they're becoming a very well-known source for home heating and cooling. Unfortunately, some of the western states like California really are kind of behind the curve on geothermal heat pumps. There's not been as many incentives for it, and much of the sort of infrastructure to support heat pumps came out of a lot of the utility service companies that were built in the 80s and 90s and then became independent companies. So, you know, you can go to Ohio and find pretty widespread use of geothermal heat pumps, Louisiana. They're very economical. There's a high front-end cost, so you're going to pay more up front because of the capital cost involved in largely installing the ground loop. But the systems themselves work very efficiently and, you know, over time are going to pay for themselves. And with current federal and state tax incentives, in many cases, can pay for themselves in a few years. And we know from studies done by the Department of Energy that there's over 600 communities in the western U.S. that are pretty closely located to geothermal resources and could be using them for everything from district heating to agricultural production, greenhouses, aquaculture, et cetera. But there's been less support for that in the United States than there has been in countries like China or Iceland or Eastern Europe.
What do you attribute that to?
I really have a hard time understanding it. When you're utilizing the resource, you ought to be trying to use it in every way you can. And frankly, sometimes using it to displace propane for heating is much more economical use of it than producing electric power.
Now, this sounds like something that could be a fairly noisy and labor-intensive undertaking. Is geothermal hot water a viable solution for dense urban areas, Carl?
Well, that's really an interesting question because we have seen some real surprises there, because you would think not, but in Manhattan, you're seeing geothermal heat pumps being installed to provide heating and cooling for office buildings. And one of the reasons they're now starting to do that, or that's becoming possible, is because, as I described it before, when you've got a geothermal heating and cooling system, you're using a ground loop, and traditionally that ground loop was horizontal. You dug a trench in your yard that you ran the loop through. Today, we have the technology that allows you to drill down and use like a corkscrew drill to put in a vertical loop, which is, I believe, the Presbyterian Seminary in New York City is, for example, installing a geothermal heating and cooling system, as well as a couple of the office buildings. So the change in technology is allowing us to use geothermal heating and cooling even in some otherwise, what you would think are, you know, unusual areas. In Europe, it's not at all uncommon to see, for example, Copenhagen. Something like 25% of Copenhagen is heated by a geothermal district heating system that comes from wells right there by the city. So it is possible. It's being done in different parts of the world, and the potential to do more is significant.
And are there rebate programs already in place in the U.S., similar to the solar and wind industries?
Well, that's one of the big problems with geothermal direct use as well as geothermal heat pump systems is they often don't qualify for all the same incentives that other heating and cooling systems do.
Why is that?
You know, I'm not doing my job, I guess, because my companies keep telling me every time they hear the words wind and solar, they want to hear geothermal right afterwards. I think it's because, first of all, people don't know it's possible. They don't see it as one of the options, so they often don't include it. I don't think they're trying to keep it out. I just think they often forget to keep it in. And as I said, as the technology is changing for both power and heating uses and for heat pump uses, the applications are getting very, very widespread. And in some areas of the country, it's much more accepted and part of the mix. In California, unfortunately, it has not been, but I hope that will be changing.
Carl Gaywell, the Executive Director of the Geothermal Energy Association, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Glad to be with you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Harry Nielsen, The Temptations, and Johnny Cash.
Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists. Go to Sungevity.com to learn more. Check out our website at SeaChangeRadio.com. That's SEAChangeRadio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.